What Canadians Don't Know About Love by Irving Layton. Love is surrender, concern, ecstasy. Bamboozled out of their wits and courage by the anti-life forces pressing against them, Canadians have forgotten this. But poets know that the great theme is love. Love's sweet torture transforms our grasping, unpleasant selves into temporary divinities and has us capering on the streets with the glory and arrogance of gods. It is the emotion that makes us endurable to one another. The flash so blinding that we cannot see wrinkles, gray hairs, skin pores, and all the other evidence for pitiful mortality. It is the alchemist in our blood and gonads converting the shabby materials of our days and weeks into incandescent golden raptures, giving our cloddish lives luster and grace. We are transformed. We walk taller, and our tears become triumphs, our cries of pain, hallelujahs, our mutterings of disappointment and failure, resounding choruses of praise. Love works on us the way great poetry does. It transports us out of our habitual selves and allows the angels to sweep new knowledge into the vacated space. When we return, we stand higher and better. The death wish, bah. There is only the love wish, the desire in each of us for superabundant power and immortality. Analysts who preach fear and retreat to their victims, resignation and adjustment, can go to hell. So can Mrs. Grundy and her numerous evil-smelling brood of censorious pigs, sniggering boobs, tight-lipped matrons, and frustrated nobodies found in all the cities, towns, and villages of this land. For these cannot endure the sight of people enjoying themselves and impose their social unease and displeasure on the timorous in the hypocritical name of virtue and decency. Who has not seen their long, bony noses and glaring eyes, their prim, aesthetic faces made pallid in the service of what they call righteous living? The really amazing thing is that they can still cow people into paying them respect, that so few have the courage to exclaim, "Let's cart them off to the booby hatch. Cart them away, I say." And all the other botched individuals that with creed or convention would keep both young and old from the most human experience possible to them, the one that of all others makes them feel most intensely alive. When Canadians are done with the excitements of professionalized sports and alcohol, a voice in their miserable, nightmarish souls tells them that contact, abandonment, passion, and the understanding heart are what matter most in their lives. Isolated from one another by fears and repressions, engendered in a materialistic society almost wholly given up to the worship of money and status, hoodwinked by egomaniacal poltroons among politicos and business executives, and robbed of their birthright of joy and intensity by any prude or long-faced Puritan that can shake a finger at them, Canadians plead for compassion as no other people on earth. This is a cold country in more ways than one. The drag of middle-class moors is strongest here, for the mitigating forces of population, culture, heterogeneity are not sufficiently present to free the individual from the entangling coils of life-denying creeds and the inhibiting ideologies and customs of the dominant ethnic groups. He's caught early and stays trapped till the end of his days. The Canadian is a born sucker for anything that will tie him up in knots. If mediocrity is someone who unthinkingly lives by rules made for him by others, then this country can boldly lay claim to being a paradise for mediocrities. Here they will find no one great heart of will to affront them. That's why it's a paradise. Can you imagine a Napoleon or a Byron or even a J.F. Kennedy living among us? We prefer the safe, the conventional, the unimaginative, the dull plotters whose fires were long ago quenched by hapless and thoroughly beaten school teachers and by repressed parents who think that sex is strictly for the birds. Yes, this is a cold country, cold with the snow and frost that have entered into the bloodstream and packed ice around the heart, cold with fear, ignorance, repression, denial. Only alcohol consumed in great quantities can temporarily dissolve this hard pack of ice. And yet Canadian poets have written some of the best love poetry in the world. When I wish to account for that fact, my reasoning goes something like this. Canadians are a backward folk. They have not yet heard that love is dead. No runner from the big outside world has brought them the news that despairing existentialist France or Marxist Russia, whose leading poetic spokesperson, Yevtushenko, has recently told us that Eros and economics should be made indistinguishably one. A lyric's inserted in the labored pages of Das Kapital. I amuse myself by imagining the mockery of a Catullus or a Pushkin confronted by this robust pleb. Our age in the great centers of civilization has bred narcissism, hysteria, anxiety, beatnikism. It has filled nostrils with the unmentionable odors of death and increased the egocentricity of the individual whose first concern today is with himself and his own survival. Think of those sprawling megalopoli whose monstrous, unstoppable advance converts fields and healthy forests into acres and acres of neurotics. Love cannot grow in this wreckage of human hopes, this junkyard. Only psychoanalysis can, to explain why it doesn't. But Canada is not one of the great centers of civilization. We have no Negro problem to settle, no Algerian one, nor one of building up the perfect state by slaughtering 15 million recalcitrant peasants, nor the problem of getting rid of colonies which we have ruled and exploited for centuries. In brief, we do not kill and mutilate and torture each other, as is done in the more advanced countries of the world. The dehumanizing forces are not so irresistibly powerful here as they are in the United States, or Soviet Russia, or Great Britain. Not yet. They will, of course, mature and ripen in time and will be as devastating to Canadians as they have been to the denizens of New York, Moscow, and London. In the interval, however, our poets have been able to write of love as the grandest of human experiences and to turn the everlasting poles of male and female for that intensification of life alone can make this long winter night endurable. And this is a country of vast, empty spaces. Desolation surrounds us, takes us in, fills our minds and hearts. We live with a white blankness nearly 6 months of each year. We can easily dissolve into it and disappear forever, unless someone out of affection and concern holds us by the coattails and doesn't let go. In this vast, empty space, in this white blankness, love defines us, gives us a habitation and a name. More than others, our poets have known this to be true, and therefore our lyrics have a concreteness and particularity and authenticity unmatched by those of any other country. For the most part, love for these poets can never be the country plaything it was for the Cavalier poets, an insincere frippery addressed to anonymous Cynthias and Lucastus. Were Lovelace to appear among them, he'd be laughed out of his affected simper quicker than one can say gooseberries. Also not for them is the artificiality of the Italian and Spanish lyrists, or the witty, highly wrought conceits of the English metaphysicals. As for the French writers, they are much too rational and prosaic to believe in love, except as a disease of the mind which ought to be analyzed minutely and compassionately. Their best poets, when they write about love, may convince themselves. They somehow never convince me. At most, they strike me as wanting very hard to believe in the glories they claim to have felt and seen. But after all, what can grocers selling herrings and pepper know about the exaltation of love, or the avarice peasants of Burgundy, or the dreary existentialists of Paris? The French are a cold, egocentric, logical people. Long ago, love was murdered there. It is its ghost, romance in all its poor glitter that haunts these places, and sensuality, which the vanity of the Frenchman wishes to fob off on the world as the highest reach of human wisdom. In the writings of older Canadian poets and of my contemporaries, I have sought mainly for those extreme statements of surrender. For that, after all, is what love is all about, when the ego forgets its strategies of protection and retreat, and men and women stand naked, revealed in all their clothless glory. These are the poems that can make us forget about the absurd homunculi among us, the censors, the shuffling politicians, the prudes and puritans, the hyperbolean life deniers and naysayers. In them, Miss Grundy and her brood get drowned and stay that way. These poems also enable us to forget the mechanical routines of a 9-to-5 existence endured by the majority of diminished Canadians. Only the poet can seize that moment, most joyful and significant in the lives of each, to confer it on the dignity of the eternal. Henceforth, every bank clerk, salesgirl, typist, gatekeeper, prostitute, fire chief, business tycoon, rabbi, school principal, and nurse walks under the white, stainless radiance which these poems shed over them. For out of the darkness and snow and mist and rain, out of the cold, climatic, and human, out of the comfortless alienation have come these astonishing words of surrender and ecstasy. Beyond illusion, cynicism, mawkishness, despair, even dignity itself, I have looked for poems that gave me the bare bone and marrow of the individual. I wanted to hear the unmistakable cry of rapture and suffering. I wanted to hear it clear and unmuffled. Love, adolescent or adulterous, tender or brutal, obscene, lustful, visionary, animal. Love, anarchic or responsible, sacramental or earthy, destroyer and preserver of conventions, rigidities, artifacts, paradox and riddle. Love, that cohabiting with death, brings forth art. And the cry at that moment when love turns into contempt and hate, when going sour in the mouth, it turns into discord, the desire to hurt and humiliate. I wanted to hear the love cry of men and women, exposed and defenseless, all coverings tossed aside with disdain or dignity as ridiculous encumbrances. For the love cry is most perplexing of all, since it is the most truly human. Body, wanton, sacrificial, selfish, humbling, exalting, coarse, angelic. For it is the one cry that by its variety and meaningfulness abashes the gods themselves in their bland heavens and makes them envious of the turbulent sons and daughters of men.